the business desk at State Broadcast News, this is the CRE News Hour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. It's Friday, August 9th, 2019. In our program today, we'll take a deep dive into the co-working space with two features. We'll hear from Tom Smith, co-founder of Truss, a Chicago-based marketplace for commercial real estate listings, including co-working locations. We'll chat with Dan Zakai, co-founder of Israeli-based co-working company Mindspace. We'll hear about how developers of a live-work-play property in Green Bay are using virtual reality in the design process. And we'll speak with author Doug Marshall, whose new book is called Mastering the Art of Commercial Real Estate Investing. We'll be back with the top CRE news stories right after these messages.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. And now let's take a look at some of the stories that are making news across the CRE markets worldwide. Thor Equities, a global leader in urban real estate development, leasing, and management, has launched Thor Sciences, a division specializing in the life sciences sector. The announcement comes on the heels of Thor's $152 million acquisition of the Center of Excellence, a 784,000-square-foot campus spanning 48 acres in Bridgewater, New Jersey. Consisting of laboratory, research and development, and office buildings, the complex features life science companies specializing in pharmaceuticals and health services, including anchor tenants Nestle Health Science, Ashland, and Amneal Pharmaceuticals. RealTerm Logistics closed on the acquisition of a 311,000-square-foot high-flow-through facility in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The property was built in 2014 with extremely rare 37-foot clear height. It's located in the highly desirable central Pennsylvania market with immediate access to I-76, I-83, and I-81. The facility is fully leased. Gart Properties, a Denver-based privately held real estate company, added another asset to its growing portfolio. The company's acquired a 155,000-square-foot retail and service center called Orchard Plaza. It's located in the heart of the Denver Tech Center at the northwest corner of East Orchard Road and South Yosemite Street. JLL arranged $42.5 million in financing for Rivet, a mixed-use multi-housing and retail property in the heart of New Jersey City University's University Place in Jersey City, New Jersey. The second phase of Titletown is getting underway. It's a mixed-use real estate development in Ashwaubenon, Wisconsin, just west of Green Bay's iconic Lambeau Field. Developers and designers are using virtual reality technology to build visual renderings of the property that users can walk through with VR headsets and even on smartphones. We spoke with Craig Pride, a shareholder with KTGY Architecture and Planning, and Danny Glimcher from Glimcher Capital Group about the project. Danny Glimcher, you are the folks who are developing Titletown. Talk a little bit about what the development is. What's the project all about?
So we are doing the residential portion of Titletown, but Titletown as a whole was kind of meant to be an economic development project for the region on the whole, not just the local region. And the Packers were looking to give back to the community to some extent. And so what they've done is they've, you know, put the amenities in place to make it an attractive place to work, live, and play. So as of right now, there's a regional sports medicine center there. done by Ballant Health. Lodge Kohler's there, which is a four diamond hotel. It's actually a beautiful hotel. If you haven't stayed, great spa, great amenities in the hotel as well. You got Hinterland Brewery and Restaurant, which the food is, Manhattan level food at the place. And there's a ton of public amenities as well. They've got, a tubing hill where you can actually get some pretty big speed on sledding down the hill. They've got an ice skating trail. They've got a lot of games and community amenities and programming and classes and things of that nature. So it's really, kind of transformed the region. They just announced not too long ago a partnership with Titletown called Titletown Tech, which is a partnership with Microsoft to do a tech incubator there. And there's a lot more coming. So now we're doing about 130 multifamily units and up to 90, for sale units there.
This is somewhat off the beaten track for developments of this kind. It's obviously in a suburb of Green Bay in Wisconsin. But how do you sell that to people who may not be looking at Wisconsin as a primary place where they might want to live?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't think it's that, although Green Bay is a smaller market for the NFL, the concept of sports adjacent real estate development is really become, more commonplace. And so I think there's, a couple of reasons for that. But the primary reason that sort of sports adjacent development came about was because people recognized that, pure public funding for, stadiums and things of that nature wasn't, for the public benefit. So you were just basically transferring dollars from one portion of the economy to another, but there was no creation of anything new. Whereas these sports adjacent developments happen in TIF districts, which are tax increment financing districts. And so the delta between the tax that was being collected prior to development and post-development, can be bonded and sold. And part of that money can go to develop the real estate where you're creating jobs and creating industry and making it more sustainable. So as far as why you'd want to live there now, the amenities in Titletown, for one, have transformed what was available before. You're also kind of at the gateway to Door County, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with the region, but it's a beautiful part of the country in Door County, and people from all over the country come and have homes there. Primarily a lot of Chicago in that region will have kind of vacation homes there. But you're, 40 minutes away from Door County. You're literally right across the street from Lambeau Field. There's a lot more industry there now. And now you've got a walkable, active area where you have a lot to do, all within walking distance of where you're going to live, which is something that wasn't really offered before in that market.
I want to turn to Craig for a minute and talk a little bit about the technology that was used in the design process. When did you decide that you were going to use virtual reality tools to design this project?
We decided to implement it into our process as a means of getting greater understanding from ownership in the level of detail or how our design was to be viewed or portrayed in the decision-making process. We were getting further along in the project and beginning to look at details and so forth. And we felt it was necessary to just kind of increase the level of sophistication to the review process. So that's why we decided to implement VR.
And what does that exactly entail when you're designing a development like this? How do you start using VR? Do you start with sketches that get inputted, or how does it work?
Well, in our design process, we use 3D modeling to generate computer images of the design, and that is good to a point. It's not oftentimes that we can take the model to the client or they look at it on the monitor screen and they get the look and feel. It seems to have kind of the next level of sophistication when you're either looking at it through a VR headset or at least just using the VR apps that they now have for your cell phones. So it becomes incredibly transportable for the client, and they can bring it back up after the meeting is completed on their cell phone and study it further or show other colleagues. and get more feedback and more beneficial feedback to the architect ultimately.
Now, in past years, I know that the amount of data involved in generating virtual reality meant you needed extremely powerful computer systems and powerful viewers and sort of almost an office environment rather than a portable one. But you're talking about people actually using their cell phones to look at these renderings. How has it changed with the advances in virtual reality technology?
I think it's changed in the advancement in the software, especially going to an iPad or a cell phone technology system allows you to take it anywhere you go. Whereas the more sophisticated, complex, kind of full virtual reality still takes a setup and still takes some more robust hardware. That's where you're putting on a virtual reality headset, and you're walking through the environment in real time. It's a little different technology than the one we used for Titletown, which was I don't want to call it VR light, but it was the cell phone technology that in the meeting or after the meeting, it allowed the ownership a way to look at how their model fits in the environment without having just to evaluate static views.
Danny, I wonder if you could tell us what your reaction was, your perception when KTGY came to you and indicated they were going to do this virtual reality approach to designing the project.
Well, I think you're seeing it more and more. It's important from a developer's perspective because you get a chance to really understand, you know, how everything fits together, both from an exterior perspective, you know, how the different buildings spatially relate to each other, but also within the buildings themselves. You know, you can look at color palettes and materials and fixtures and finishes and all this business, but until you've loaded it all into the model and you can literally walk around a unit, you don't really have a sense of how it all fits together. At least in the past, you didn't. You could, you know, some was left to the imagination. With virtual reality, you can be in your apartment before your apartment's built.
Does this streamline the process in any way, or does it make it more complex because of all of the data that has to be loaded to create the virtual environment?
Well, I think a lot of the, you know, I don't think it slows it because a lot of the data you're using is data that would have been available anyways. It's just how that data is processed. So I don't think it slows it. It certainly, it speeds it in that, you know, you can make decisions much more readily, you know, in that you'll see something and you say, okay, that works, that doesn't work. Whereas before you didn't have that opportunity. It's also become a great sales tool because people who bought the early units and condo developments and things like that in the past, they had to, you know, kind of leave it to their imagination to see what it would be. They have an idea, you can sit there, you can put a rendering board together, but you weren't able to walk through your particular unit and say, I want to change that, I want to change this. Now you have that opportunity and you can see what it looks like, what you're buying.
Craig, what were the challenges you faced with this particular project? Was it more difficult than others you've done in VR, or was it a pretty typical approach?
I don't know that there were no challenges with the VR. I think the challenge in this particular project is just working through the level of sophistication in design and how the project design was put together with regarding the context that it was being put in. So the Titletown project is a very unique project in that we're building out portions of the project that have already been completed. So there is a center green space and public space that's already been completed, and our project sits to the side of that. And so we were trying to use the virtual technology to kind of tie those two pieces together to give them a better understanding of how our project would integrate into the existing development.
Now, does the virtual reality rendering of this space just provide the walk around views of it, or does it include the other details that are behind the scenes that would be incorporated in blueprints in a traditional architecture?
No, it really focuses on the imagery and not the details of the actual construction, wall construction. I think the entire project and Titletown development is a very unique project from the standpoint that it's being developed by the Green Bay Packers as a football organization, but it is really an entertainment community, and we're very excited to be able to provide high-end luxury housing as a component of that entertainment zone that's associated with Green Bay Packers.
Craig Pride is a shareholder with KTGY Architecture and Planning in Chicago, and Danny Glimcher is the founder of Glimcher Capital Group in Westport, Connecticut, one of the developers of Titletown near Green Bay, Wisconsin. Thanks both of you for joining us to talk about Titletown.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the CRE News Hour from statebroadcastnews.com. Small businesses looking for office space often turn to co-working companies like WeWork in 1776. But now there's another option thanks to a Chicago-based company called Truss, T-R-U-S-S. Tom Smith is the co-founder of Truss, and Truss has just moved into the Philadelphia market with a platform that provides information about 400 available office spaces under 10,000 square feet and 20 co-working locations in downtown Philadelphia. The expansion follows Truss getting a new round of $15 million in A2 funding. Truss now has more than 300 million square feet of available office, retail, and industrial space available on its platform. We spoke with Tom Smith, the co-founder of Truss, and he described to us some of the features of the platform. Tom manages business development, finance, and data analytics for the company. Before starting Truss, he gained more than 20 years of entrepreneurship experience focused on financial growth in technology. He co-founded various firms, including Netrex, Sullivan Wayne Partners, and Exalt, which was acquired by VeriSign. He joined us by phone from his office in Chicago. Tom Smith, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate the time, and we're interested in how you differentiate yourself from all of the other folks who are approaching this co-working space issue all over the market, particularly the Philadelphia market, where there seem to be an awful lot of players. How do you make it work?
Well, we make it work by focusing on the customer, which many people forget about, which is the tenant, the small business owner looking for space and in a very confusing landscape, and being able to take all the market options for them and aggregate them in one place and one view, whether, you know, we have over 20 co-working providers, the 800-pound gorilla WeWork being just one of them, just in the Philadelphia market that we have on platform, and as well as, you know, hundreds of other traditional leases for a prospective business to be able to see all the co-working and all of the traditional workspace options in one view and an apples-to-apples cost comparison. And no one else is doing that. And the price is free. So it's a really revolutionary service that people, you know, expect almost in the residential side, but it's unheard of on the commercial side.
So how do you make it work where it's free for people to use? What's the model?
The model is actually taking a traditional tenant rep broker model, which is if you're a larger business, you get the attention of the commercial real estate brokerage community, and those folks are paid by landlords for successful leases. We've taken that model and then brought it downstream. So basically democratizing that and allowing people have the same level of access. And we get paid by the landlords just like the big guys do. And then we're able to then pay for the platform costs and create this wonderful experience for tenants, really piggybacking on the existing pay for performance that landlords are used to. It's just never been attainable for small and medium businesses before.
Now, are you doing all of the traditional things that would be associated with finding the space and helping people lease the space, or is it just more of a directory to get them introduced to the people who are actually listing it?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is a key differentiator. We're a full transaction platform. So we not only help match them through the discovery process, but also provide all of those higher level advisory services that large companies are used to from their broker. So everything from meeting them for physical tours, if they desire, advising them on market pricing and negotiation. We do actually all that negotiation on platform, and we help educate them on the market. And then all the way through lease negotiations and consummation. So they could stay on one platform, and we're unique in that we have both the listing and search capabilities, as well as sign. So search to sign, one view with a local expert guiding them. So we have local resources in the market that know it neighborhood by neighborhood and block by block.
So what are some of the kinds of assignments you're getting? What are some of the more interesting requests from people looking for space?
Well, it varies quite a bit. We've had extremely large companies looking for small satellite locations. So Lacoste is a good example. They're used to being very highly serviced by their the brokerage community, but some people are looking to be in control of the transaction and it be more efficient. And so Lacoste wanted an office. They found it on trust, and we transacted with them. So we never were expecting a large company like that to be one of our first customers, but it appealed to them on being in control and being efficient. We also get a lot of companies that you would think could have maybe outgrown co-working. So we have a couple companies that were growing from 40 to 80 people. They thought for sure that they would be moving to traditional space, and through trust, we were able to find them some co-working promotions that actually paid for half of their first year's lease, which is unheard of. So it's you never know which way it goes. We see big companies coming into co-working, and of course the traditional matriculation out, but being able to identify promotions and do that has made it really exciting. There's never a dull day.
And just so I understand, the space that you are identifying for people is not just co-working
space.
That's
right. So what's unique, it's all office space options. We're primarily focused under 10,000 square feet. So that is really the beauty of this, is to be able to compare a WeWork right next to a traditional lease and be able to see what those cost per month comparisons would be. In one view, and that's, no one else has that 100% price transparency. That's that trust requires of our suppliers being the landlords that are and co-working providers that are trying to market their spaces. They're not allowed to put spaces on trust without giving us full pricing disclosure, so that we can really educate and provide a real service to the customer and start the transaction off right.
So what kind of advice would you give to companies, large or small, that are thinking about using trust to look for space? What are some of the things they should be keeping in mind and looking for?
I think they should give us a try. It's free. I think it would really open their eyes, whether they've had great service with their traditional broker or not, they're really going to be pleasantly surprised that they are able to view this availability and then move forward when they want. And there's nothing like it. So my advice is give it a look. It doesn't cost you anything. And I think we might surprise you.
Now, your press release says that your expansion into the Philadelphia market involves more than 400 spaces and 20 co-working locations. What does that mean?
Yeah, so there's so of the spaces we're focused on under 10,000 feet, just in the really kind of urban core of Philadelphia, we have, and that number has increased, but we have over, 400 options for people to compare. And then within each co-working center, when we say there's 20, that's 20 locations each that have, could have hundreds of options within each one. In terms of the size of spaces, one person office, 20 person office, 10 person. And so that those 20 co-working providers, represent probably, over 1,000 of actual spaces. So, you have a couple between them and the traditional spaces, a couple thousand options just in the urban core of Philadelphia. And, we're real excited. That represents well over 80% of what's available in Philadelphia right out of the gate. So you're getting a full market view, and we're increasing that number every day.
And you seem to have some plans to move into the Philly suburbs in the near future. Where do you think you'll be going first in the suburbs? Is it too soon to tell?
It's too soon to tell, but that's it's well underway, and there's a lot of excitement by landlords that in the suburbs that are looking for new ways to market their spaces and kind of capture the Philly market in a new way. So we're thinking we're going to be in the suburbs sooner than we thought. So, probably within a month or two.
Anything I didn't ask you about the platform, Tom, that you think is worth mentioning?
It makes looking for office space exciting. I mean, it's interesting to see, even if you're not looking for space, for example, what the your options are, across the street or within your own building, and things that you just don't have visibility on. Even if you're not ready to get in the market, I encourage people to come to Truss, and you'd be shocked at how much rich information there is. And yeah, you might decide to make a move one way or the other before you thought, because you're educated. So you don't have to be ready to lease right away to come on to Truss and let us try to show you what's going on.
Tom Smith is a co-founder of Chicago-based Truss, which provides a technology-based platform for businesses looking for smaller office space and retail and industrial space as well. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to the CRE NewsHour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. Mindspace is an Israeli co-working company with locations across Israel, Europe, and starting in the U.S. in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. And it offers co-working spaces that attempt to infuse local elements into office design, underscoring its commitment to collaboration and open space while retaining a cosmopolitan atmosphere in its offices around the world. Dan Zakai is co-founder and CEO of Mindspace. He established the company in 2014 with co-founder Yotam Alroy. Before Mindspace, he founded G-System Solar Solutions, a solar energy company, which was later acquired. Dan, thanks for joining us on the CRE NewsHour.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So tell us a little bit about Mindspace. It's a co-working company. It's a global boutique kind of approach. What is it that differentiates Mindspace from some of the other co-working spaces that people are familiar with?
Yeah, so Mindspace is a global brand. We operate in 7 countries. We started in Tel Aviv, Israel, and we now operate in Germany, Poland, Romania, UK, the Netherlands, and the US. What makes us boutique is the fact that we pay close attention to detail in the co-working spaces that we create for our members. It starts with the selection of location. We always go in prime cities to prime locations and try to aim for unique buildings. In terms of design will make you feel comfortable, will make you feel at home. We take inspiration from the local scene of the city, from local artists and local furnitures that we source in those cities. We place what is always a larger team on the ground than you would normally find in other co-working spaces. And all of that just to provide an excellent customer experience and a boutique experience to our members.
So you're in some of the major cities of Europe, and I notice you're in three cities within Israel. What are some of the typical users of your co-working space working on? Are they all, I mean, the typical, what people think of co-working spaces as being for is tech startup companies. Is that generally your experience, or are there other kinds of companies using your space?
That's an interesting point, because an interesting observation, because that was the situation, you know, up until like 3 years ago. So when we first started 5 years ago, we aimed, and we had usually startup companies, freelancers, you know, we still have those groups of companies. But what we're seeing that is happening over the past 2 or 3 years is that enterprises and larger companies are moving into co-working spaces, getting what we call as an office as a service. So we have now at Mindspace over 40% of our members are what we define as enterprise companies. We have companies like Microsoft, Barclays, and many other great brands in our facilities. And this is part of the movement that you're seeing in the co-working arena right now. Larger companies moving in, realizing that they get a lot of benefits from being a part of a co-working space. And it's actually becoming an alternative solution, an alternative real estate solution, you know, to traditional leases.
Is it your sense that these companies, these large companies, are going to be permanent residents in co-working space, whether it's yours or somebody else's, hopefully yours, of course, or are they using this as a temporary measure to gauge whether or not to commit to their own office space in a particular market?
I think what's interesting in today's world is that most companies today are in fact incapable of planning ahead, you know, as in the past. And therefore, you know, the traditional lease model for 7 or 10 or 15 years is no longer relevant or no longer efficient to many of the companies that we're seeing. And those companies, you know, they use Mindspace locations not always as a swing space. Yes, sure, we have those companies coming in for a defined period of time until they will have, you know, their HQ ready, or until they will decide whether they need their own space or not. But I believe that co-working or flexible workspace solutions are becoming a permanent solution for companies as part of their real estate strategy. Now, it's not always, you know, that it doesn't mean that they will place all of their employees at a co-working space, but, you know, it could be some of the teams, maybe the regional offices for which they need more flexibility, that they will go for a flexible solution. But I truly believe it's becoming a permanent solution to the real estate strategy.
What kind of a reaction do you get from the landlords of the buildings where you want to put in a co-working space? I mean, landlords are happy to rent out space to anyone who wants to rent it out, I guess, but the co-working is maybe in their minds looks less permanent than booking, you know, a Microsoft or a company like that into a 10-year lease. Do you get any pushback at all?
Landlords today, you know, the more advanced ones, realize that co-working or flexible workspace, you know, became a necessity to their building, became almost as an amenity to their buildings. We have seen landlords telling us, approaching us, saying that they had potential tenants wanting to take space in their buildings, but insisting that the building will have some flexible workspace in it. So if their team grows, they can, you know, outgrow their lease by using a flexible workspace solution. So that's one. The second thing is, I believe that landlords understand that if there's a quality operator in the building, it brings in new energy and new life into the building, which makes the building, at the end of the day, more attractive. Mindspace today is considered by many landlords in the markets in which we operate as an anchor tenant that attracts other tenants as well to the building. And what we're seeing more than that is landlords who realize this phenomena, realize that flexible workspace solutions are going to become a growing segment in this market as time goes by, are looking to partner up with co-working operators such as Mindspace in the form of a management agreement and in the form of activation of additional spaces within their own building. So I can tell you that Mindspace right now had partnered by now with various landlords across the world, basically, to create workspace, a flexible workspace solutions in the buildings of landlords in a partnership model, in which we don't just create flexible workspaces, but we also operate other amenities in the building for the building and the rest of the tenants.
And that seems to be happening with a number of the co-working spaces being built in the U.S., that some of the new office construction here is being designed with co-working as part of the model for the floor plan as the buildings go up. Tell me a little bit about the community, because I know that in co-working spaces, one of the things people regard as being an important amenity is the community space, the cross-fertilization and collaboration that can take place even by accident as people meet each other in the common areas.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to label that for a second, I think that the community is a part of a bigger hospitality approach that some of the operators, such as Mindspace, are taking in how they manage their spaces. So effectively, what we're saying is that we realize, and companies realize, that in order to attract and retain the best talent that there is in the market, companies need to provide a better work experience for their employees. And now, realizing that, you know, there's a bunch of things that you can do to make it happen. So you can provide an excellent customer experience on every touch point with your customers. And one of them is community. So at Mindspace, we do a lot of things, you know, to create that community sense and to bring on more features and more activities to our members, which is something that we intend on bringing to the rest of the buildings as we partner out with the landlord. But effectively, what it means is that we create workshops, we bring contents, we create, you know, constantly events that are happening within our spaces, trying to connect people to partner up and work with each other. So almost an endless amount of activities that are conducted within the spaces and are managed by Mindspace and by the Mindspace team.
So one of the things I always wonder about is, how did you get started in this? You didn't just one day decide you wanted to build co-working space. You must have had some sense of that there was a need for this. How did it come about?
Yeah. Look, I've worked for various companies in the past. I was an investment banker. I had started my own company 10 years ago. In the solar energy business. I think that, you know, the one thing that I came across all the time is that I want to work in a space, in a place that, you know, creates a better work environment. I mean, we spend most of our days in our offices, and Mindspace was a unique opportunity to take that and to try to change that, while understanding that there's something happening in the market. There is a big change that is happening in the commercial real estate market nowadays, and we can be a part of it, and we can make an impact and take advantage of it. So, you know, it's the co-working industry has a solid business model. If you do things right, then you can have a profitable company and a healthy business, you know, while actually changing people's lives and making, you know, and creating a better work environment for companies and employees.
So I'm going to show my East Coast U.S. bias here and make a note that of all of the office cities that you have listed on your website, the two that I see not yet listed are Philadelphia and New York. Do you have any plans to expand there? You're in Washington, D.C. Any plans to come further north?
Yeah, we definitely have plans to continue our growth in the U.S. And Philadelphia and New York are definitely on our radar, and happy to update, you know, as we have made some progress in those markets and others.
Is there anything you can say about why you chose the particular cities you chose in Europe? Because they're, you know, to some extent, they're the obvious ones like London and Berlin, but you also have Utrecht and Bucharest on the list. And I'm just interested in how those get chosen.
Yeah, so we're a company at a high growth mode, which means that, you know, we've built a scalable operation that enables us today to go out and launch almost any market that we view as an attractive market. Now, it's always a matter of prioritization. Where do you want to be? and what are the resources that you have in order to do that. I can tell you that in the Netherlands, for instance, you mentioned Utrecht, but in the Netherlands, for instance, we have made an acquisition of a local company which had location in Amsterdam and Utrecht. And in Bucharest is a growing market with a lot of talent. A lot of enterprise companies are moving into Bucharest, which is being extremely developed. And we view that as an attractive market. So, you know, every market has its own dynamics and its own reasons. It's not always the same reason for every market. But at the end of the day, we've had a good opportunity in those markets that we found suitable for what we offer.
Are there, we talked about the U.S., are there any other markets that you're looking at moving into that you can talk about?
We're looking to continue expanding in Europe and continue our, you know, extending our footprint in the U.S. market. So, at the you know, right now, the focus is on U.S., Europe, and continue growing in Israel as well.
Dan Zakai is co-founder and CEO of Mindspace, a global boutique co-working provider. He spoke to us from his office in Tel Aviv, and you can get more information about the different locations of Mindspace by visiting mindspace.me. Dan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us about it.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
We'll be back in a minute.
Shalom. This is Rabbi Richard Adress. Join us for our podcast series from Jewish Sacred Aging entitled Seekers of Meaning. We'll explore some of the issues and events that impact ourselves, our families, and our Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging.
The Seekers of Meaning podcast airs every Friday morning at 8 a.m. at JewishSacredAging.com. Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. Doug Marshall is a seasoned commercial real estate professional for more than 35 years. He's worked at mastering the art of commercial real estate investing while securing the best financing possible for his commercial real estate clients. During the last decade, he's also invested in rental properties throughout the Portland, Oregon area where he lives. Doug holds an MBA from the University of Oregon, and in 1999, he received the CCIM designation, which many people consider to be the PhD of commercial real estate. In 2003, he founded Marshall Commercial Funding, a commercial mortgage brokerage firm located in his town of Portland, Oregon. He's the author of a new book. It's called Mastering the Art of Commercial Real Estate Investing, How to Successfully Build Wealth and Grow Passive Income from Your Rental Properties. And he joins us to chat a little bit about the book, which is published by Morgan James Publishing. Doug, your book is called Mastering the Art of Commercial Real Estate Investing. What made you decide that there needed to be a book about how to invest in commercial real estate?
Well, Steve, thank you for having me on your podcast. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. And to answer your question, I started blogging about 12 years ago and started talking on various topics that I thought were important to the real estate community. And two or three years ago, decided that maybe it would be best to put together those blog posts into a book. And so that's how it got started.
So one of the things you do in the book is to try to point out to people ways to build wealth and grow the passive income from rental properties. What is it about that that strategy that made you decide to let people in on the secret?
Well, first of all, I don't think it would be fair to say that there are secrets to anything in my book. It's basically common sense principles that all investors can benefit from. And I believe the real success in investing in commercial real estate is that it happens to be the best source of passive income that you can invest in today. And passive income is what we really need in order to achieve financial freedom.
So tell us a little bit about the tips that you're giving people. What are the five most important lessons maybe you've learned over the course of your career?
Well, I would say, you know, the best way of going through that process is that there really are many things that I've learned over the years from my my clients. I am a commercial mortgage broker by profession, and I have noticed that they, that my highly successful real estate investors, do certain things the same way over and over again. And I think that they have, first of all, a very simple approach to the numbers. They don't go through a convoluted way of figuring out whether they want to purchase a rental property. So they have a fairly simple approach. And that in itself is a great step in the right direction.
So when you're advising people of the kinds of commercial properties they should be considering for individual investment, what are the sectors that you like the best? And talk a little bit about how they generate the passive income you're talking about in the book.
Well, personally, I like to invest in apartments, but you can invest in any type of income producing property that you find of interest to you. But the advantage of going with apartments is that you have a higher probability of keeping an apartment occupied with a high vacancy if you have 20 or 30 or more units. You don't have to be concerned as much about a vacancy if one or two people happen to move out.
Mm-hmm. Are there other kinds of properties that people can look at in your mind that makes sense for individual investors?
Oh, absolutely. I think office, retail, industrial are excellent property types as well.
One of the things you talk about in the book is that people end up being afraid to pull the trigger on actually buying the property. What do you think is the reason that happens?
Well, the primary reason is fear, Steve. And there's really two types of fear that people have a problem. When one is the fear of failure, and the other one's the fear of the unknown. And fear of failure is all about it's all about having a mindset of you win or you lose. In reality, what we need to create is a mindset of you win or you learn. And in everything that we do, we either make the right decision and we can kind of do the happy dance and be thankful that we did it, or we learn what not to do so that the next time we can have a better outcome. And I think that if we could change our mindset from you win or you lose to you win or you learn, it makes a big, big difference. The other aspect is on the side of you have that fear of the unknown. And a lot of times people can get over that fear of the unknown by asking five questions before they purchase their first rental property.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to ask you about the five steps. You talk about five basic decisions that people should be prepared to make.
Yes, the first one's a really simple one, and that is you want to be an active or a passive investor. And an active investor is someone that makes all the decisions about the property, and the passive investors let somebody else make all those decisions. But if you want to be a passive investor, then really you really only have one question that you need to answer, and that is, who do you want to have as your real estate sponsor? Or maybe a better way of putting it is, who do you want to trust with your money? And if you want to be an active investor, then you have three other questions that you need to answer. And the first one is, who do you want on your real estate advisory team? You know, who do you want helping you to going forward making good, wise decisions for you? Who's counseling you? And then who will be, how will the property be financed? And then thirdly, how will it be managed? And if you answer those three questions, you know, the fear of the unknown is significantly reduced because you've just answered three very critical questions about your future rental property. So those are the five questions, and it begins with whether you want to be an active or a passive investor.
When you look at the real estate market today, the commercial real estate market, everyone that I talk to seems to be very optimistic about how things are going to go the rest of the year and over the next maybe 18 months or more. What's your sense about the economic outlook, and what are the things that you keep an eye on that potentially could be red flags for the economy and for decision making?
Well, I think that we have to figure out where we are in the real estate cycle at this particular point in time. I can't speak for the entire country, but in the Pacific Northwest, our real estate market probably peaked a couple of years ago, and now we're kind of in the downward cycle. It's still a good market, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't as good as it was two or three years ago, where we saw double-digit increases in our rents, and we saw very, very, very low vacancy, and everyone was who was in the real estate market at that time was doing exceptionally well. And now things have changed. There's been new products on the market. Vacancies are up a bit, and we're seeing a moderation in rents. And because of that, we've peaked in the marketplace, and going forward, I'm still buying rental properties. I've actually purchased two this year, but it becomes much more difficult today to be able to find those properties than it was several years ago. And so you have to be more cautious from that standpoint.
You work primarily in the field of commercial funding, I guess, and people do make mistakes when it comes to financing investments. What are some of the common mistakes that you see, and what are the tips that you give people to avoid those mistakes?
Well, many times I see people going back to their existing lender, which is nothing wrong with that, except that they should be checking out what other lenders can offer. I mean, the chances of that same lender having the best rates and terms in the market are pretty unlikely. Another big mistake is that a lot of people that kind of are in the first stages of buying a rental property many times will use their residential mortgage broker. And a residential mortgage broker is clueless when it comes to financing commercial real estate. And they need to find a qualified commercial mortgage broker that can help them out. Thirdly, they try to finance the property without using a commercial mortgage broker. And sometimes it's penny wise, pound foolish. They really need to use the experience of the mortgage broker, because he knows the lenders out there in the marketplace that are financing properties that are similar to the one that these people are investing in. So they need to use his services. A really huge mistake, though, Steve, is I've seen it where you've got a lender on board. They're excited about your property. They'd like to finance it, and the borrower slowly dribbles the information into the lender. Or worse yet, they might start arguing with the lender about the necessity of providing that documentation, and you know, that's just a death knell. You don't want to do that. You never want to violate the golden rule of lending, which is he who has the gold makes the rules.
And you have to be pretty well educated to keep an eye on these things. How do you manage that process if you're not a commercial real estate professional, but just an investor who knows a bit about it?
Well, I think it's all about putting together a real estate advisory team that can help you. You need to have somebody that is a real estate broker on your team that can provide you good counsel. You need somebody probably on the property management side. You definitely need somebody who is has the lending experience that can provide you good, competent counsel. And then you also need to have somebody that can go through the property with you so that they can help you with identifying any deferred maintenance on that property at the time of purchase, so that you know going in just how much money you're probably going to need to do the capital improvements that are necessary.
So those are some of the mistakes people make in the financing side. What are some of the pitfalls they face managing the property?
Well, I've noticed over the years that the biggest mistake is, well, really is, it's not managing your apartment manager or your manager of your property. If you have one, if you have an on-site manager, you get what you inspect, not what you expect. And that's probably the number one thing that I see that happens with most people. They do not oversee the management of their property. Another one is, for example, you might find a manager of a property who does not, it takes way too long to get a unit market ready. And in a tight rental market like we have pretty much these days, for every day it takes to get a unit ready for occupancy, it takes money out of the pocket of the owner. So I've seen where vacant units have stayed dirty and unrentable for several weeks just because the on-site staff is not focused on getting that unit ready in a timely fashion. And I would also say that the other mistake that owners can make on a regular basis is not paying their employees well. A good employee is worth his weight in gold. And I really mean that. It's very, very true. I, in a previous life, was a manager of about 700 units in Atlanta and Nashville. And the thing that I learned most, Steve, was that that the unsung heroes of real estate are the on-site property managers. They can make or break you.
We talked about the property types that, and you say it's pretty much across the board that people can be looking at different property types in the commercial space. What about geographies? Do you have any particular geographies that you prefer over one over the other, or can people find good values investing in pretty much any geography?
I think that's a really important question from the standpoint that you can find a good deal anywhere, but I would highly recommend or caution your reader or your listeners to invest locally. So I live in the Pacific Northwest. I try to keep my when I purchase a property, I try to keep it within a couple of hours of where I live, so I can go and drive by the property. I get the opportunities to invest in other parts of the country, Arizona and California and a few other places over the years. And I've always said no, because I need to have the ability to, I don't know the markets as well over there, and I need the ability to actually go buy it and see how it looks from time to time. I believe that, you know, what I've seen over the years, Steve, is that I'll come to a property that's being purchased, and I'll for my job today, and the buyer is looking to finance this particular property, and I look to see, I travel to that property, and I see that it's in horrible condition, and I find out later that property is owned by an out-of-state owner, and that can happen easily if you don't have the ability to drive by it on a regular basis, because you're making way too much. You're trusting your asset to somebody that may or may not be looking out for your best interest. So it's important, in my opinion, to invest within a short distance from where you live.
Doug Marshall, CCIM, is the founder of Marshall Funding in Portland, Oregon. He's the author of Mastering the Art of Commercial Real Estate Investing, How to Successfully Build Wealth and Grow Passive Income from Your Rental Properties. It's published by Morgan James Publishing. Doug, I appreciate you taking the time, and we wish you good luck with the book, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again at some point.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, for having me on your show.
And that'll wrap things up for this edition of the CRE News Hour. You can send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas to steve@statebroadcastnews.com, or you can leave an audio comment for us using the voicemail icon on the homepage at statebroadcastnews.com. And we tape this program in Studio A at State Broadcast News in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Join us again for the next episode of the CRE News Hour next Friday at 8 a.m. Eastern Time at statebroadcastnews.com or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Steve Lubetkin. We'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.